Welcome, listeners. As I drive down this dark, diverse highway and pause to pick up John Aitken and Bob Fleming from Prog to Who, trek this out and take your seats. We are on a journey of discovery into the imagery and mastery of Lynchian landscapes, the efflux of stories interwoven in a tapestry of films. This is The Lynch Mob.
And welcome for another Lynch Mob. We've not got that many films of them left, but this is the one we've all been dreaming of doing. It's June from 1984.
Now, the most widely read, talked about, and cherished masterpiece of a generation comes to the screen. Dino De Laurentiis presents...
Dune, it wouldn't be fair to say it was a total nightmare. But... maybe 75% nightmare. And the reason is I didn't have Final Cut. I had such a great time in Mexico City, the greatest crew, cast. It was beautiful.
Dune, a world beyond your experience, beyond your imagination.
Who's taking the first run?
Right, so...
did you like the camera work?
Well, he bought a proper camera this time. Obviously, I've been investing from Hollywood. So that was a bonus. I've not seen this for years, and I don't remember liking it very much. I think it was, I mean, it was a long time ago. I'd have been young and probably looking for Star Wars, and obviously this is not Star Wars. And I tried to watch it when John reviewed it for Turkey Seats. I bought the Blu-ray, thinking I'd watch it, and I watched it with my girlfriend. And obviously dystopian dark science fiction is maybe not her thing. So when you're watching it with someone who's not, you can tell is not enjoying it. I didn't enjoy it, so I knocked it off after about 20 minutes. So I had no expectations in coming to watch this, obviously with, you know, Lynch not being a massive fan of it as well and all that. And I fucking loved it. I absolutely adored it first watch. And and then I did a bit of research online and on the bonus, you know, features on the Blu-ray I bought, which obviously was not a dodgy copy this time, so I didn't have to spend another fucking £6 because the camera worked shit. It's a proper film on that. I really enjoyed it. And then I watched it last night with my headphones on in the dark, full effect.
Tackle out.
You are. but it's fucking beautiful. It's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
There's many good things about it. The one thing I'm gutted about is that I immediately went, director's cut. Is there a director's cut?
Yeah.
And what...
Never will be.
No. And obviously he was like, nah, you know. But what I liked about that creative process was that you find a lot of creative people will go back and do something again and again and again until they get it happy with it, get it right. He just washed his hands of it. You know, he's like, nah, fuck off. If you're going to mess about with it, I'm off. He's off. He went to do something else. So kudos, or not kudos for that, because I would love to see his version.
He learnt a lesson in that one, yeah, I think.
I mean, he absolutely did. I'd love to have seen that 3.5-hour cut, because I think that... Because it wasn't... Because David Lynch, he got on very well with Frank Herbert. You know, he was discussing about his thoughts, what he thought. You know, he was really involved in the project from the point of view...
Yeah.
He had the author there. The author was really keen to talk to him and you know, go through everything and everything like that with him. And, you know, I think Frank Herbert, he wouldn't speak to that. There was a producer lady called on this film. The lady that produced it.
Raffaella De Laurentiis.
Yeah, because
I
think he was a bit of an old man, was Frank Herbert, like a bit sexist, and he didn't really talk to us. So anytime she asked him anything, he would just go to the index in the book and look at it there. But with Lynch got everything, you know, and Frank Herbert loved it. And he's the guy that fucking wrote it, do you know what I mean? So,
you know, I've got an absolute similar tale. I was thinking I'll come on this podcast with everyone just hated it. And I watched it with... new eyes. I watched it a little bit for John's review, and he actually did me review himself, but mainly based off my idea of when I watched it, I think back at college as well. And then I thought, right, I'll watch it in the eyes of the David Lynch stuff. So you sit down and you're going to absorb it. And I did. I thought the music was amazing. I thought the sets were beautiful. I liked how the mixture of like Art Deco theme and like new and old. It felt to me like Terry Gilliam on acid, a lot of it. You know what I mean? You could see it there. The costumes was really, for its time, very futuristic, and it was totally not Star Wars, but I think Universal and everybody wanted it to be Star Wars.
Yeah.
And that was a shame, really. But after watching it again, and like I did similar to you, I just watched it alone and I just absorbed it. And I thought, you know, this is what he made was good.
Yeah.
I'm not slagging it off. It's a shame he couldn't do everything he wanted to do. It's a shame he couldn't complete what he wanted to complete. But what he had to put together in the end, to me, was good.
Well,
I enjoyed it.
I'd love to see what he did put together.
Yeah.
As in his first cut.
All the actors in it was great. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you've got
some of the best people behind camera as well, who's worked for him throughout the time, like Freddie Francis. His last film he did with him was A Straight Story, wasn't it? And then he passed away a few years ago. You got some brilliant music from Brian Eno. Now, I usually think he's a bit pretentious, a lot of his stuff, but this was great. His music was amazing.
And Toto.
Yes, surprisingly enough.
Well,
I had to read that.
I'd have never known if it wasn't for some cheesy guitars coming through, you know, a bit of the Flash Gordon kind of Queen kind of sound. But no, the soundtrack, like I said, headphones on last night, the soundscape was brilliant. And directorially, like shots, what's on the screen visually is fucking
brilliant.
For
a man's third main film after coming out of Elephant Man and Eraserhead, which are supposedly art films, you could look at this and go, wow.
Yeah.
He was given a huge budget and even had Frank Herbert's backing with him at the time, didn't they? Which is unusual for a film to have that.
Yeah.
So I was pleasantly surprised that I was enjoying it.
Definitely. I'm definitely with you, Cliff.
What do you think, John?
I'd like you to refer the Honourable Gentleman to the podcast I made previously on this film.
So can listeners go to his now?
Yeah, listeners, just fuck off.
No, I pushed to review Dune last time because I love Dune. I love the sci-fi element to it. I love the way it's a kind of like super futuristic. I love the ideas that are in the book. It made me read books. And re-watching it for this, I was thoroughly engrossed all the way through, even though I know I've just watched it like a year ago.
Yeah.
But I just love the film. I think it's fantastically done.
Yeah.
There are lots of parts of it that are... There's lots of sci-fi tropes as well as fantasy tropes in it, in the story, the Frank Herbert story. And I think it comes across as... The only real downside I have for it is the second half of the film, or at least the last third.
Yeah.
Feels rushed.
It just feels rushed. Definitely does feel rushed.
And a lot of the elements there, the feeling of the vastness of... the sheer scope and scale of the of Muad'Dib's rise to power, which in the books is given full service, was not given service in this film, but I was aware of that, and I still really enjoyed the performances. I enjoyed the sheer sort of... I think Kyle MacLachlan's performance is brilliant.
Yeah,
I love him.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah.
And Everett McGill's appearance is always a treat for me, especially Big Ed. I've always remembered ever since I first watched his film the way he pronounces Muad'Dib, and I just love it. And that's like I was always fascinated by him before Twin Peaks and before I knew who he was. And
he was definitely he was definitely... I know it sounds stupid, but he was definitely acting because I've never seen him like that before, playing like kind of a spiritual person kind of thing, and he was brilliant because I didn't twig at first it was Big Ed, and I did twig that it was Jack Nance as well.
Yeah,
you know the big guy in the ginger wig and the, you know, Sting's mate, and fucking Sting was in it. Like, I know he did films at the time, you know, Quadrophenia and stuff like that, and he does a Cockney accent. And he's a Geordie. Why are you doing that, Sting? Call the police.
He wasn't doing a Cockney accent.
He kind of was. What is this? What did
he was doing? Not, he was doing a sort of neutral, posh English kind of thing accent. But no, I really liked Sting in it. I thought
he's
he was great.
Yeah.
He was menacing in just the right way.
Yeah, yeah.
The smirk of a Geordie singer. So
it came across as that perfect cycle which you wanted, and he was for the film. He was a good-looking guy placed there. He didn't have to come out of the flaming shower scene with a codpiece on the shower. But it was obviously done for a bit of like, well, it is a bit of titillation. But
we've all done it. We've all done it.
All jumped out of the shower in a weird pointy codpiece and just gone, look at me, ladies.
But to be fair, he looks fucking ripped.
He looks ripped.
I don't know whether it's...
But where's his hairy absolutely... back?
He's definitely.
I mean, that's not normal, Cliff. You just got to remember that. Just because you are one.
He's definitely being waxed. That's for sure. He's very smooth.
Absolutely, the people who he worked with in this. If you look, who he's worked with in the future from this, time and time again, he's gone. These are brilliant actors, and he just kept with them. Obviously, Kyle. Obviously, Everett. You know what I mean. Dean Stockwell as well, and then he came back to do Blue Velvet after this. There's tons of them. Even the little girl who plays his sister, she ends up in Twin Peaks 3, or the season
and
3.
Two?
Yeah.
Does she?
Yeah.
She's a little girl that plays the piano. She's the sister of... I've forgotten her name. She's one of the sister of one of the...
Proper spooky, she is, that little girl.
That's another thing that I remembered, particularly from originally watching that, was the uncanny nature of her acting on that. It seemed uncanny. Because when you see it leading her into the room, she's like, she's fucking tiny. Yeah. She must be, what, 4 or something, or 5 or something. And the sort of confidence with which she delivers the lines and...
Perfect.
Yeah, she was uncannily good. I really enjoyed that performance.
I think everyone's performance in it, even the Vladimir Harkoman. Is that his name? Harkoman. Vladimir Harkoman.
Harkonnen.
There we are. Yeah. But that to me was, this isn't Star Wars now. You know what I mean? He has his little.
It's so grittier.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's dark. They show blood. They don't show any blood in Star Wars unless you're bloody green and then they might show it. But this was like, this isn't for Star Wars. This is for adults. Even though it comes as a rating, I think 12 at the time. I think it might have been 15.
Was it?
But he has a very much a high homoerotic part with it throughout.
Yeah, listen.
that was some initial. There was some initial kickback on that because it was kind of implied that homosexuals are disgusting.
Oh no,
that was the imagined criticism of it.
I think it was
back when it came out in the '80s because it came out right in the bang in the middle of the HIV epidemic.
Yeah.
So
right,
and there was a lot of that sort of stuff in there, but it's true to the books.
Yeah, it's true to the book.
I just want to touch on that. Well, that the Baron, and this kind of Clockwork Orange-esque.
Yeah.
That whole thing, like, you know, it's dirty. He's dirty, and it's just, he's disgusting with his face. And, you know, he's a degenerate. He's all these bad things, and it's portrayed and filmed really well. Yeah. And he's awesome.
He acts the shit out of it. Yeah.
And the whole floaty scene, because there's that bit of tension before Sting, there's another younger looking, more effeminate male who comes to change the flowers, and he floats, but in the end there's a big grandeur and all that, and he comes back down and just rips his thing out of his heart, the blood's going everywhere.
That was so cleverly shot, because he comes through white, giving like a virgin appeal, so I'm assuming he drinks the blood of virgins, I don't know, you know, with that, like an old tale of drinking the blood of virgins to keep alive. And that's how I got it, because he was the only one dressed in pure white. He seemed to have innocence about it.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that the way it was shot in each part, the sets in it involved, apparently they built the sets, I think they started it 2 years even before it was started to get filmed.
There's
so much money that went into it.
Huge, grand, awesome looking sets, like a sort of, you know, like a futuristic kind of 50s vintage-y kind of glamorous... or 1920s, I don't know, you know, just like it has an old-fashioned kind of antiquity look to it, but it looks grand.
You were right in mentioning the Art Deco, because there was a lot of that. And I think a lot of the design of all that sort of stuff was based on, I mean, H.R. Giger had a lot to do with it as well. And the guy the people who did Alien, the set designs and things like that, and model work was using those similar people. But I think the thing that you can best say about this film is that everything is every staged piece is vast.
Yeah.
You get a sense of scale, which is always important, I think, in sci-fi. And just that opening scene where the navigator is getting wheeled in his massive tank.
Yes.
And
brilliant. Really, yeah, like, slow and methodic. It didn't need to be rushed. And those, like,
solid.
Similar, those, like, degenerate disciples which he's got following him with the shaved head. And they have
to... Do you know what they were wearing?
No, what was it?
These were body bags that have been used. They were used body bags. He didn't tell the cast that they'd be used.
That's freaky.
But
wow.
This is what happens when you record a previous.
Yeah, you get to know everything, especially when we suck it.
Previous thing about it. Yeah.
Oh God, yeah, sucky information, man. I love the microphone as well. The translation,
yes,
mic.
Yeah,
that was a brilliant idea.
It's all these touches like that it just added so much to it. Now,
because I'm sick and tired of when it shows a sci-fi film and all of a sudden everyone speaks English, or they've got an explanation that it's we've got some kind of translator. I love that idea that they knew that they had to have this.
And really I think what, touching on what John said before as well, like the last third of it, it's crazy rush. You've got like three segments in which all end in massive, amazing battle scenes with hundreds of extras, and it looks great. But it just sort of skips, you know, when he just suddenly goes, and then loads of stuff happened, and then it moves on. You know, it literally in five seconds, and I was like, well, that's the disruption of this film, or what Hollywood have done. You know, to sort of put some negatives in, but you know, and this is what the studio has done in the edit, was the massive exposition at the beginning by the lady, that would have never have been there, but was only there so they can make the film over an hour shorter. And I think there was a lot of overuse of the thought, you know, the monologue in the monologue stuff as well, which was useful.
I liked the princess's opening monologue. That was like, you could see that was just like chopping 30 minutes of film out.
I think it was used like intermittently, it was great.
But the end
it just uses it loads to go, let's get it done. Do you know what I mean? There's that like whole thing, last third, let's just do loads of it, let's get it done. And that's a shame, really.
I just find it must have been so frustrated, because we're watching it after a series of Lynch films, what we've watched, and we appreciate his stuff, but we can also see now his anger for Hollywood from this film.
Yeah.
It should have been two films. Can you imagine if you got the budget and said you can make two films and do it as you want? Can you imagine the expanse of what you've done? It doesn't need to be fast-paced. Everyone's gone, it's not Star Wars. You don't need fast-paced. Watch a David Lynch film. Don't need it.
But the studio...
Yeah, they wanted bums on seats, but it was never going to be a Star Wars.
No, but I mean, they missed a massive opportunity, because Dune, the actual books... are always perpetually top of like the top sci-fi 100 lists, for a good reason, because they hit a lot of tropes, they do it in unique ways, and to transplant that into a film, you've got a massive fan core base that are going to watch it.
Yeah,
but they let them down so badly.
But even then, like, I'd just love to see. I just wish that when you with a film, you wouldn't have kept it, but just to see his cut, I think.
He never got to make one. No,
well, I thought his first edit was the 3.5 hour long thing. The studios went, no, we need to take out this, that, and that. And that's when he just went, fucking do what you want, walked off, didn't he, really, pretty much, by the sound of it. Washed his hands of it, which was brave and big of him, you know. But he was invested in, he obviously directed it, but he also did the screenplay for it, didn't he? You know, with a lot of input from speaking to Frank Herbert a lot.
He worked hard on it. It wasn't just thrown in. Yeah. He worked hard. He threw himself into it, knowing it was a huge amount of budget for the time. What's that equivalent of now? 30, 40 million? Nearly 100 million as a budget?
It won't be cheap.
Something like that, must it? But the good thing is, he still had the the support for the De Laurentiis family afterwards. So a lot of the films, what he did afterwards, he still had the support. I think they all knew who was to blame. Universal pushing.
Well, he's been famously quoted as people have asked him what advice would you give to potential filmmakers, and it is have editorial control, because without that, what comes out on screen is not your vision, and if you're going to make something and put your heart and soul into it, it needs to be your vision that comes out in the end. The problem is that studios are such fickle small-minded things, but they think in terms of numbers, where they don't think in terms of art. And that's why David Lynch getting Twin Peaks 3 was stroke of genius by HBO.
Yeah, yeah.
It's because they let him, and what you get out of it is something increasingly special.
They let him, and not necessarily, money in as well.
Not necessarily popcorn stuff, which is what the studio wanted.
Yeah. No, but they put the money in as well to Twin Peaks 3. And this man can paint a picture, slash shoot a picture, that is like nothing else. That no, you'll ever see again, or before, or whatever. Like, this is Dune to me. Now, I've not read the book. I've listened to half the audio book of, you know, the order.
It's hard work if you're not like into that stuff.
It is, but to be fair, the audio book's brilliant. They've got different voices for people and all that. It's not just someone reading the book out. There's so much in it. It's a massive, like, it's kind of biblical. You know,
absolutely.
That's
it
the
is.
Scale of it, yeah. Isn't it? It's huge.
It's the fantasy trope of like the Messiah thing. It's entirely messianic. He is the chosen one, the Kwisatz Haderach. He's just essentially, you are the one. And when you go on to read further books, and maybe you've looked at some synopses of them, but the scale of it, I mean, he disappears after a few books, does Paul Moerdijk, but it takes place over millions of years.
Right, okay.
It's like leaps about of it, but the empire that he forms in the next group and what he manages to do, and what the actual Kwisatz Haderach is and the whole mystical element of it is a trope that's been well trodden, and it's a wonderful idea on how to turn that into a story that Frank Herbert did.
100%.
And when it comes to David Lynch's adaptation of it, there are glimpses of that. He takes what would normally be a sort of tropey "you are the one" thing,
yeah,
and makes it sort of easily done. It's so easily enjoyed, but also it's so flawed. But I really, really enjoyed watching it again.
I really enjoyed it.
I was proper enthused about it. I wasn't like bored.
I think a lot of people was just. I think a lot of critics have jumped on the bandwagon at the time, and I wonder how many actually watched it and appreciated it.
I think
it.
The critics are right. In terms of like, it's a failure of a movie.
Yo, but some of them went to just absolutely slate it completely. When I think you can appreciate it on one side, but yeah, it shouldn't have been rushed. Yeah, it should have been two. Yeah, you know what I mean. But they should also have an appreciation of someone's work.
Ian, do you want an interesting fact about it?
Yes, Sookie. I mean, John.
200 workers spent 2 months hand clearing 3 square miles of desert for this.
Wow. I mean,
the Mexican desert.
It is beautiful. It's so vast, obviously, because it's a desert that's been cleaned for months or by people. Mm. But everything, the spaceships as well, unique, the tubular ships, class. Mm. I think there's two effects, and it's only by today's standard. And one I kind of love, and one's the he's not a space worm. The guy in the tank who's out the tank in his tubular ship, that's a bit shit, but it's kind of cool and trippy at the same time, you know, because you're never going to get whatever it is to look like, you know, some whatever I don't know, but it just looks a bit shit, and
some of the CG. Was it Matt? What's it called when green screen and stuff is a bit shit.
Some of it's not that big.
But there's only that, and then there's a bit where he spikes the worm to ride on it. That looks a bit crap. But apart from that, like the battles, the spaceships, the sets, the suits, you know, the armor suits.
Yeah, the whole design of everything.
You know what?
Is
it gave me the idea when I saw the suits, and I was like, you tried to take your notes as well. You can see where Jean-Paul Gaultier got his idea for the Luc Besson film. You know, Fifth Element. The suits are the same.
Yeah, 100%.
But obviously a lot more bright and garish. But they're the same, that like leather touching towards bondage look. You know what I mean?
But that's another one, another film I love. But it's all this like really grim, graphic, disgusting, dirty sci-fi. You know, a world that's been lived in such a massive, you know, just a massive idea as well.
I mean, the characters are just completely and utterly to the absurd degree. The Baron is absurdly grotesque. He's literally grotesque.
I love how over the top he is. I love it.
And the Duke is just, and Paul Atreides are just pure good, strong blue. You know, it's good versus evil.
Kyle MacLachlan in this, he's perfect. This young, innocent looking guy. You know, a boy becoming a man. Well, yeah. A god, really.
He's supposed to be 15. The character's supposed to be 15, but he was 25 when he did
it. He's quite youthful, but the way he played it from innocence to, you know, becoming what he became, yes, he was still good at heart and all that kind of thing, but he had to do things like ride a massive space worm in to kill people. And I just want to say, the voice gun thing, which obviously he gets to...
Yeah.
The power he gets at the end naturally.
The weirding way
is just fucking such a great idea that you have to use these words. Ooh. Power of words. Duh. Yeah, and all that. And then when you fuck it up, it was like, you know, something would go wrong. Hmm. Such a crazy, awesome, unusual idea. Just loved it. Loved that.
Like for instance, when he's just killed Sting. And he just angrily does a weirding way without the sort of module attached and breaks and cracks the floor, which is an epic moment.
Yeah.
And I do love the fact that you get a voiceover again from the guy behind him going, he did that without a module.
Yeah.
He truly is the one. Yeah. And that, like, oh, that's exposition done in a really interesting way as well.
Yeah, I like the expedition when it, although you can see...
Expedition.
I liked it when he was having a battle with Sting, and then you saw that the cheeky knife come out of this blade out, and he even says, "I bet that has poison on," something like that.
Yeah,
and I thought, "Oh, this is just brilliant." You could just go right into it.
Weird floaty pen scene with that little woman from James Bond who has the pointy shoes.
Yeah,
shut up, mate.
She's ace. She's great. Great character, but there's loads of.
I don't think she's in James Bond.
Maybe she's in. She's in somewhere where she's evil and got pointy shoes. I'm sure.
I think I said that in the podcast. Though. I don't remember.
Quote John Aitken, but you've obviously got Patrick Stewart as well. Like fucking brilliant, and he
weaponizing a pug,
and also gets
that pug into battle.
It takes a pug into battle, and also got a great mullet by the end. That's when you know time has lapsed because Patrick Stewart's mullet is massive. Obviously, I love Quantum Leap, you know, Dean Stockwell. You've got Max von Ming the Merciless, who, you know, I'm pretty sure he would have been a big actor at the time. It's fucking...
What, Max von Sydow?
Yeah. Max von Ming, as I call it, just called him because I didn't know his last name. Yeah. But, he was brilliant.
Blood Raven.
Yeah.
Also, I really enjoyed seeing David Lynch in the film as well.
Yes, that was brilliant.
I think that was great.
Playing himself, as always, which was great, seeing him in like a weird sci-fi kind of thing.
Yeah, it's great.
But all the backing, what he's got, all the actors, like we've said, he's got all the sets was beautiful. Where did it go wrong?
The edit.
Edit.
Yeah, 100%.
It's so simple that, wasn't it?
It's like they stopped worrying about it after they'd filmed a bunch of battle scenes in order to mash them together, and then it's the clunky way in which they've gone from like and then sometimes past.
Yeah, that was the bad part. Yeah.
That broke the immersion of you being in the film and watching it because I think the most important, most interesting part of the book, one of the most interesting parts, is the how he develops that power, how he integrates with the Fremen,
how he builds it up. It's really interesting
because it's just a couple of scenes. Yeah. Welcome to the Fremen. You're a Fremen now. Now you're leading it.
Yeah, it was just that could have been another couple of hours. You know, like a couple of hours, like three and a half, four hours. This film would have been class, and there was the material there from what I can gather, you know, to make it.
Should have been
100%. But I mean, there's little things that I loved as well, and this is probably your David Lynch things. There was like when Jack Vance has this drink, it's like a mini elephant that he crushes.
That wasn't Jack Vance.
Was it? Oh, sorry. You know,
that was his brother.
His brother, yeah. He just crushes it and.
That's Fade's brother, the guy who ended up with his head.
That's why I got confused. I got mixed up because they had
ginger people all look the same, but I wouldn't worry.
Most gingers look the same, but that just little stuff like that was cool. You know that
the sound as well.
Yeah, it was
you
gross.
Wouldn't get that in a Star Wars or a family film. It was too. It touched to side of grotesque. isn't it?
There's lots of silence as well. There's not silence, but there's lots of no background music, which is just something that films fail to do. They need it all the fucking time.
There's a wind and tension.
Yeah.
Because when my headphones on last night, there was this sort of all the way through.
Yeah, the typical Lynch, you could tell he's been playing around with it. It was, I loved that, but because we've watched so much of his work, you could see him in it. And I was so glad that I could see him in it for this time, because obviously the first time properly watching it years and years ago, this time I was watching it trying to be what David Lynch had produced, and you could see him all the way through it, which was good.
That's the characters, that's everything. You know, how people are playing it, just capturing stuff, putting little bits in that maybe were the book, but emphasised, and just to make this world more and more real, so you get that buy-in as well, I think. I mean, stuff like the suits... You know, the sweat, the moisture suits or the sweat suits.
Still suits.
Great idea. And then me being an idiot, I'm thinking, what, the piss and shit? And then they even tell you that in the thigh pouches. It's like, what? That's brilliant. I didn't even need any more exposition. Thank you very much. but it's just, I'm fucking gutted. It's not got the full thing it deserves.
One of the, just going into the actual plot of it, one of the things I really enjoy about it is the steampunky kind of aspect to it.
Oh, yes.
Which is, they have Mentats to do the thinking and computing. They're Brad Duff and the other guy, I forgot his name. Yeah. But they're the ones, because in the books, it's kind of gone into a bit more detail that computers developed AI sentience and caused a shitload of trouble, so eventually computers were banned, and so they found a way of making human computers, which is what these Mentats are. So every big house, like Harkonnen and Atreides and whatever, has their own Mentat, which is their personal computer and strategist.
I love that, and they use
the red juice to do advanced calculations and things.
Because
I love that aspect that everything's gears, and steam and
crunchy
stuff,
yeah.
And there's no computers anywhere, and you can see that the design of all the ships, the interiors of the harvester stuff, it's all very, I don't want to say steampunk because it's not, but it's all very.
Well, it was ahead of its time, because you can see Terry Gilliam used the same type of stuff in a lot of his films.
Yeah, I think apparently, from what I can gather, the new Dune, which is going to be
two parts, but he's
only been commissioned kind of thing for the first part, so it depends on the success. But he said,
it'll be a massive.
I'm sure
success.
It will. But these, and even the suits and the design he's put in,
same
because they were that good, they were that brilliant. The spice is the worm, sacred water, all this stuff. So the spice, what does it do? Because it's your eyes go blue and make you.
It's a psychotropic drug.
Yeah,
but it also allows these navigator creatures to fold space and to navigate through faster than light speed, because they can't use computers,
right? Okay,
to do stuff like that. So this allowed them to. So taking the spice away would mean that those creatures couldn't navigate anymore. So light speed travel would be gone. The universe would be finished. Everybody would be localized at whatever planet they're at. So it's the biggest and most important thing, and to make a single source of it on this one planet. It's just a great concept, the melange.
So it's basically, like you're saying, because I think it's kind of missed that point.
It's heavily addictive. Drug.
Sounds very Moorish, but like the point of it is then. Because that's not really emphasised, this lack of computers, and the computers took over, so this is why they're adapting humans to be computers and to be navigators. And that's what the spice does. Because you train yourself, don't you, or something like that. That's kind of what I've got.
Well, to normal people, it's just a psychotropic drug that's very addictive, but the navigators can use it to navigate and fold space in order to travel faster than light. And that's why the navigators, as is made clear in the first scene, there's an emperor... And he has to do with the fucking job of the navigators. Mm. They're telling him what to do.
Right.
And they take no shit from him, because they're the ones that are in charge, because they're the ones that can have kept the entire empire together.
Right.
They're the power behind the throne.
Allowing you to more or less invade a country within minutes. You can just fold and then move the whole lot straight.
Yeah. They don't travel at faster than light speed. They just... go from one place to another. Yeah, it's instantaneous. Like, space. Yeah. It's the warp space.
Is that, the scene with the big fat space worm in the tube in the ship then, when it was all getting trippy, was that what that was trying to put across?
It was trying to put across that it was navigating towards that planet.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. So it wasn't just a cool trippy scene. There was an actual point to it, and I missed, obviously.
It wasn't dead. It was left very Lynchian to your interpretation.
That's come in. It was fucking cool. And now you say it, it makes perfect sense. I think one of the other scenes that really stood out for me was when he was with the mother, Madam. Not what did she call Madam?
Jessica.
No, not Lady Jessica. The mother of.
Oh, the Reverend.
When they've done that, she's got like the pointy.
The gumpy bar.
And then goes in the box. Oh, yeah. And the hands burning and all that. That looks fucking ace. And that it's just great. Well shot. So
fantastic. That's basically the first chapter or so in the book. So right. it's kind of the defining feature of Dune in a lot of ways, is the idea of, and that mantra, fear is the mind killer.
Yeah.
And that he goes through, that's just like, and the whole test of that is if you put your hand in there, an animal would instinctively have to take it out, and it's only a human being that can override animal instincts.
Right, okay.
And it's like anybody that uses the excuse, I couldn't help myself. You're just an animal. Then you're a human being. You can do stuff to stop yourself.
Ah, right. Oh no, that's super cool.
And that's why, and that's the idea as well, that there's a, and it's taken into other fantasy tropes as well, where there's a sort of a female version of power and a male version of power that the females can't get to. There's a book called The Eye of the World, I think it is, by Robert Jordan.
Mm.
It's like 12 book fantasy thing. It's massive.
Right.
And that's got a yin and a yang kind of thing, like the female matriarchs are all able to access this magical source. The male can't because they go mad.
Right.
And it's the one time when, and that's why the Kwisatz Haderach is the one that can access that male side of power.
I thought the way he did that was amazing. That was very Lynchian when he started going in, when he goes into the desert and he takes the water and the drink.
Water of life.
And then he ends up with that trippy. It did remind me a lot of the end scene of the Elephant Man. You know, when it going using the planets and space, and he's really pushed the boundaries himself on that part.
Yeah.
Each shot you could see, you know, when usually they build a set, they go, right, we're gonna use this set and use it again and again and again. And you could see sets only used for 10 minutes, that's it.
Mm.
And a whole beautiful set, even so high it went as well, was all constructed. But you've got to remember, this is way before the time of green screen to just drop in. This wasn't like MCU where they just done it in his studio and the whole lot's green behind them.
That's why it's better and real. That's why these Marvel things look like a cartoon, a bland cartoon to me.
Yeah.
I think it looks terrible, but this looks fucking different, class, real and amazing kind of thing.
It's richly textured.
Beautiful, yeah. 100% beautiful.
Do you want to know some more facts?
Yes. I'd love to know some more facts, John.
Who was considered for the role of Paul Atreides was Val Kilmer.
Oh, that'd be...
Oh, young
he was
Val
one of the ones. Yeah. Christopher Reeve auditioned for it, and Dexter Fletcher was in the picture, apparently.
Oh, God, he was in
it. Rob Lowe.
Rob Lowe, wow.
John Hurt was up for Dr. Yui, and Jack Nicholson was up, turned down the role of Gurney Halleck.
Oh.
Helena Bonham Carter was up for Lady Jessica.
Interesting.
Glenn Close was as well.
What year was this made, by the way?
84.
Right, okay. So it was off the back of Star Wars and...
Like there was a lot of sci-fi that came out around this time, which purports to be off the back of Star Wars, but I don't think the filmmaker thought that. I only think the studio thought that.
Yeah.
But at that time, though, if you think about it, you've got, in the mid-80s, you've got a huge run of family-orientated blockbusters. You've got your Ghostbusters, you've got your Back to the Future, you've got your other parts of your Star Wars coming through, and there's a huge amount of Steven Spielberg was blasting. Everything he did was just jizz hot, wasn't it? So I think they was thinking they was going to jump on the same bandwagon. But within the first 15 minutes watching, you're not watching a film for kids.
No. But I think you had, in the 80s as well, you had quite dark sci-fi, obviously Blade Runner, but you had like Running Man, things like that. I know there were Arnie films, but they were quite graphic in their own way.
Yeah, but even Blade Runner at the time wasn't a success, was it, when it first came out?
No.
It's only years later that people appreciated it, because, again, that was considered too dark for the time. They had to go and change.
I suppose, yeah.
And I think, likewise, Dune has been appreciated later down the line, but I also think that doesn't stop everybody knowing that it is a flawed film.
Yeah. You can see it's a flawed. If you read the books, you can see the flaws in it. Like, it's the second half, like John said, is perfectly that it's rushed, and it shouldn't have had the rain scene at the end as well. That just was a bit silly.
I mean, the thing was that the rain scene in the books is such a massive climax to it all.
Yeah, but this was just came because, like, it's just raining outside.
I would just add that on those 30 seconds of people being rained on. It didn't give it the amount of majesty and sort of like reverence that it deserved.
And I don't think that's his fault. I think, again, he was rushed to put something together like this.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
I think, I'll tell you what I picked up on, and it was just, this is a bit silly, was the fact that people had normal names, like Paul and Duncan. You know, like, you had a lot of magic, awesome sci-fi names, but you had just normal names.
But this is what I mean, it's in our universe, the year 10,000.
No, it's just, it was quite unusual to have that in a sci-fi, or science fantasy, I want to call it.
I like that, though, because I've read a lot of fantasy in the past, and obviously if you've read Lord of the Rings, you can get yourself so tongue-tied with the amount of different names.
Yeah.
Which are so confusing, and it makes you think, if someone just sat there for 3 hours trying to think of a bloody name, just use any name. It's perfect. And the names, to me, was perfect.
There's random generators that could do that for you.
What about...
believe me.
You never hear Clifford. How come there's not a famous Clifford, apart from a big red dog?
Cliff Atreides. There you go.
No, but I do like the idea that it's set in the same universe as Earth, and we exist.
Yeah.
And the year system is like 8,000 years in our future. And Earth has been lost. Nobody knows where the origins of the human species have been lost by this point. But you can see links to it by things like names.
Yeah, it was just a cool thing that stood out to me. It was again unique, which this film definitely, I think, is a unique film.
But there's lots of eugenics in it as well, isn't there? So there's the Reverend Mother in there.
Yeah.
1,000-year sort of breeding program that's led to Paul Atreides, and there's stuff that you don't really understand, like Lady Jessica, his mother, Paul's mother, is Harkonnen's daughter you don't know about. Yeah, that's why she's got red hair, by the way. That's why she's got red hair in it, because she's a ginger too.
She's one of the ginger people.
And that was why she was told not to produce a male, because it's part
ginger.
Of the breeding program. Yeah, that's maybe it. But she basically, the whole idea of having such an organization of mystical, religious sort of female matriarchy, not that that's a tautology, a matriarchy that has managed and molded these huge noble houses for so long, that definite end goal in, and that's pure fantasy.
You see, I find the part in the books about the women in connection to the books a lot stronger than what they appeared within the film. I don't know if this is because it was being cut to pieces and shortened, but
what do you mean?
Well, in the book, the women are a lot strong characters.
More in charge.
More in charge.
Being the Baron. And
then in the film, they felt they was more running around for the men within it.
I think it looks like, again, I'm not read the book, John, correct me if I'm wrong, but when they rushed the last third... when they rushed the last third, there's a lot of development that we don't see with the daughter, with the child, with the passing down of this... Mother, Reverend, or whatever it is, you know, and stuff like that.
I mean, Aaliyah is her absolute genesis, and what she comes out is just basically a one shot of a fetus thing, and the voiceover saying, "This is Aaliyah." She was like, you know, da 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 da,
yeah,
and that's where she was. But the explanation for what she is and how she lives, and in subsequent books, how big a part that she plays with Paul. And the fact that Paul and Chani don't last forever. Don't mean to break it to you guys, but they don't last forever.
Oh, they were so in love, them kids.
Yeah, they were.
But he turns into a proper god emperor, where his He sees the future. He sees it all. You can't usurp somebody in that position. So he rules for like thousands of years.
Because you've got that family nosebleed at the end, haven't you? You know where the mum, Paul, and the little girl are all got no, like a family nose, telepathic nosebleed.
They're feeling his pain, like, aren't they?
Yeah. And that's there's no that's just, again, it's just quick. That whole end bit of it, they've just been maybe an hour long rather than...
And again, just a scene like that is, you know, touches more grotesque than a popular sci-fi at the time. It's showing blood. I can't think of an 80s film where it's shown, you know, blood in such a way where it just looked real. You know, when he attacks the young man, he gets the tubes pulled out of him, the hard blood,
yeah.
And then you've got the blood on the faces, like you said as well. You won't see that in anything else. And it just shows that he wasn't aiming it for bums and seats. He wanted to aim it to please the Frank Herbert audience and also have a new load of people enjoy the sci-fi and maybe go and get the book as well.
I mean, we've seen it many times that books, successful books that are translated into film, never do it fully justice because a film is a truncated medium.
Yeah.
You've got 2.5 hours to do it. And a book has got a vast... You've got hours and hours and hours of prep time. You can add exposition as you go. And a film can't do that. So I think... But what he's done with the film to make it like it is very true to the book, stylistically.
Well, Frank Herbert loved it. He openly admitted that Frank Herbert was a big fan of it. And he wrote the fucking thing. So that's quite a good testament to the film, isn't it, surely?
I think he loved the fact that it was being made. I think he had a good relationship with David Lynch as well.
Yeah, he did.
They all must have had a good relationship. By the sounds of it, in the back behind the cameras, just the pressure from the Universal, wasn't it? But one thing I wanted to bring up as well, which it reminded me a little bit of, was: do you remember the old late '70s, early '80s? Animation film adaption of Lord of the Rings.
Oh, God, yeah.
I couldn't comment.
I love that.
I loved it. I fucking loved it. But it never did well, and they never did a number two, number three.
Well,
it's
a similar situation.
But it's a similar way of I related it to this, because it was, they said it's an unfilmable film, it can't be done, and it just needed more time to be appreciated.
I mean, that animation, the good thing about that Lord of the Rings animation is at that time we were all fans of the Lord of the Rings. I mean,
yeah.
I was obsessed by it.
I was about
15 or 16. And then to find there was an actual... Because we never thought it could be made into a film.
No.
And the animation... the annoying thing about it is that it gets to a certain point and then it goes... And then they
stopped.
Then he went on a quest and like, it finished and it was all good. But it's like a similar thing. Just lack of willingness
it
to do it.
Through that, because at that time, I remember watching that for the first time and I thought, oh, wow, no one's ever going to do a film of that. And you can imagine maybe this was that. You know what I mean? They brought it out and everyone went, well, we told you it couldn't be filmed.
It should have been 2 or 3 films.
Yeah.
It could
even have been at least 2. Yeah.
Definitely 2. I mean, by the sound of it, I keep saying this because I'm so gutted that we didn't see his original edit or whatever it was, the 3.5 hours.
Apparently there's a television one which you can get downloaded. Now, mine was...
Don't.
But I've not seen it.
It's awful.
I've watched 3 minutes of it and it looked terrible.
It was terrible.
So
I didn't want, especially now we've all got big TVs. You just see some of that, I just appreciate it.
Dune
is one of those films where we could have really have done with the technology being good enough to do it justice.
Yeah.
Film technology, like Lord of the Rings, when it came to be, because suddenly we had the computer generated ability to do huge fucking army scenes and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And if that's why I'm really looking forward to this reboot of Dune, because they have the technology to make it vast as well.
I think the look of it, I mean, like I said, cause just from doing some, not research, but looking at the trailers and bits that...
That is research, Bob. Don't put yourself down.
I suppose it is, yeah. Thanks, John. But he has taken a lot from, visually, from this. You know, I think that's testament to Lynch's vision.
Yeah,
the
still suits are an absolutely brilliant design. The whole idea of them, nose thing. And it makes no sense. Because you sweat out the rest of your head as well.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But I love the fact it is fantasy. It's a fantasy film with that sort of science. Yes, element.
Yeah. I think that's where people get it wrong. They think it's just sci-fi, and I find it heavy towards a fantasy.
God, massively.
Side. Totally, totally. It's the hero trope, yeah. Fantasy. It's the although the difference is it's not a fanboy that becomes the hero of the chosen one. Yeah. It's the Duke's son.
Yeah.
You know what's really strange is we all put this off. I mean, it was like, oh, you know what? Even the last one we did, we went, you know what? We'll have to do Jude. And I thought to myself, right, let's give it a go. And we've come back and we all enjoyed it, which is good. We're just a little bit upset on the heart of David Lynch that he wasn't able to fully do what he wanted.
But like, hats off to him for just, that's so hard as a creative individual, just going, do you know what? Fuck it. Move on. Like, that is like,
But he didn't really move on because he had like real issues afterwards.
Because of it.
Massive but you can issues, see yeah. that. You Fucking can see that coming one. Through his films afterwards because he refers massive, to this a lot.
Massive hatred for that big blockbuster Hollywood whole scene.
Yeah,
isn't
I mean
really?
Mulholland Drive. Yeah.
It did affect him quite a little bit.
Well, you got to think at the time as well how old he was. He's still a young guy, and he's still boss. You know what I mean? He has to be a director commanding two film crews because he had his mate doing one bit, which was all like the water scenes and stuff. And he had Freddie Francis doing the main shots. And he had a huge cast of people to work with. And he's still a young man who only done two films before this.
He definitely had what is the phrase when you're not confident about your own abilities. He was at that point. He was in a massive set with a huge organisation required. He had lots of big actors that knew their shit more than he did as a director, who was only in his 20s. Well, it would be early 30s maybe at this point.
Yeah, early 30s. Yeah.
And
I'm glad he jumped back up though. I'm glad at the end of it he thought, you know what, I want to do my own stuff.
Yes.
But he used it and he learned from it, and you could see that through. You know what I mean? I'm not saying
learned a lesson.
But he also picked up a trope of people who he loved.
Oh, yeah.
And he still loves to today, and he still works with them today.
But Jürgen Prochnow, I always liked him from Das Boot and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Playing the Duke.
Yeah.
He appears in The Convenience Room, doesn't he, in Twin Peaks? Fire Walk with Me, I think it is.
It does, and it makes me happy that this happened to Lynch so he could go on and do the movies he's done. But he was touted as being the next big director, I'm presuming at the time. Eraserhead, people loved it. Got Elephant Man.
Yeah.
Nominated for an Oscar. Dune, if he'd have gone on from there, if he'd have maybe done what the studio had said, he could have. I just couldn't see Lynch being that guy.
We would have got Mulholland Drive, though.
Oh God, no! This is what I mean. This is why it's a massive thing in Lynch's career.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that he did a film prior to this, obviously, Razorhead was his baby. Elephant Man, he can deliver a film for someone else and make it beautiful and awesome. And he could deliver amazing sci-fi, which is great and beautiful if you give him the chance.
Mm.
But because budget was so big. They just.
I think also he could have got another big blockbuster if he, you know what I mean? It's not. It's happened before where they've tried, but the people behind it, backing it, you know, Dino De Laurentiis, he loves the guy, David Lynch. So he could have easily got the backing of him to try again for another one, but it's not like he didn't want to. He just thought, I want to do my own thing. You know what I mean? He needed that control. It doesn't matter about the money being thrown at you.
Which you definitely don't get. I mean, there's Star Wars is a good example for. You say about Lord of the Rings, the Peter Jackson one. In Star Wars, you had George Lucas, who made his own special effects. He was inventing things very similar to what, you know, Peter Jackson did with Lord of the Rings to make this thing this epic scale. And there's some of that in this, you know, that was used in maybe films like Alien and other sort of sci-fi at the time.
People like James Cameron used to do that, like The Abyss, where there's the whole fluid water thing.
With
the face. They develop technology to do that. Filmmaking where they have to develop technology to make it work is the best stuff.
Yeah.
Because you've never seen it. It's like, wow, this is just fucking brand new. David
Cameron's always said that it makes the films when the technology's there to make it.
Yeah.
And he like Avatar's a big one. It doesn't matter what people say about it. It was groundbreaking at the time.
David Cameron, Tory politician, yeah. David Cameron Cliff. All right, yeah. Didn't know he made it Avatar.
He made Avatar him. He all did, right. Yeah.
I see.
But making the film with the technology at the time, you could do that. Okay, I understand his feeling there. So he's probably got a load of films on the back burner he don't want to do. But David Lynch tried it with what he had.
Yeah, yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
There's some. This is majority. It's brilliant. Sounds brilliant. Looks brilliant. It's just edited badly.
And yeah.
Short. I think the content was probably there, you know, to piece together something that was going to be 90% awesome, I reckon.
It was artistically good, but it was
100%. Yes, absolutely.
Functionally didn't function correctly, but. Yeah.
But it's definitely watchable. I'd recommend people to watch it.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I'm not going to say don't watch it. I say watch it.
As long as you manage to like dislocate any cynicism out of you, like when they're saying he truly is the chosen one, kind of
the
thing.
Worm
which
is
like
the worm. The spice is the spice. The worm. Worm is the spice.
What is the spice? But the worms as well. They were mega.
Brilliant.
They were such an iconic thing that we remember. Even the film didn't do well, but. Everybody knows about it.
The thing I remember is the thingy in the tank at the beginning, the shield harvester, the shield suit fight.
They invented the technology for that as well. That was the first time they used CG, body. They used humans acted to do the CG to do the computer graphics. That had been done as well.
That was awesome.
That was cool.
And I just remember the worm, you know, but it was like a bit, it reminded me of the worm in, a little bit of the worm in
Star Wars.
Return of the Jedi, which was a bit shit.
That's not a worm, that was just a Sarlacc pit.
Well, it has the mouth of it. Yeah, yeah.
But also a Drashig from John Pertwee's Doctor Who, because they do the big
worm. I knew a drop of Doctor Who in.
Which were hand puppets. There were hand puppets coming up from the thing. But it was, I think the thing I loved most about it was, The spiritual side of it is massively spiritual and biblical, just a bit like Cobra Kai.
I can tell we're coming to the end of the pod now.
Mr. Miyagi, I mean, he's one of the most spiritual individuals on fictional television. so I can see a lot in Cobra Kai.
You're breaking up, Bob. You're breaking up. I can't hear you.
Well, obviously, we'll have a last round. I think Bob's gone over to Cobra Kai. John, do you want to say a last one?
No, I don't have anything meaningful to say, just other to reiterate the fact that I love the film because it looks beautiful. The care and attention to detail in the design of the suits, the design of the Harkonnens, and the little Lynchian touches of like occasional just holding a scene for just a little bit too much for everybody else. Just let people drink in the scale and all that sort of stuff. I see plenty of little Lynchian bits in this film.
Yeah.
Enough to make it worth watching for anybody that wants to like absorb that shit.
Yeah, definitely. I think if you're following Lynch like we are, then watch it. Definitely worth a watch. And like I said, I know I said it before, but to me it's very much like the beginning of a film which at the time might have just not had enough backing of it. And it's a shame, but we've got the new one coming up now, which has a lot of backing on it, and I'm expecting it to do amazing because of the technology. But David Lynch had his own vision, and you could see it throughout the film. And then you could see parts of it a bit rushed as well. But it's enjoyable, and it's well worth a watch as well.
I agree.
Definitely.
And we've got two left, and there's only... we've got no choices now to do. So we've got Lost Highway and Eraserhead.
Lost Highway and then Eraserhead, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's Lost Highway, this bad boy.
It's going to Lost Highway from 1997 and then it's Eraserhead and then we'll have to go on to Twin Peaks then.
get deep rewatch. In Twin Peaks.
Because I've been wanting to rewatch Twin Peaks for
ages. Yeah, I'm holding off because of this shit.
Yeah, I've been really watching, and then I've got a few ideas of what we could do with that as well. We could watch it and maybe do a talk over as we're watching, if you like to do that. I think
director's commentary.
I've held off that massive, awesome Blu-ray box set I bought, apart from watching episode 8 from season 3. I've not watched it, so I've held off.
You see, the person behind Blu-rays has been able to send both his children to college three times over because of the amount of you buy.
I'm not surprised. I had to fucking double buy. That's bastard. No,
you didn't have to. You're just an idiot, Bob. That's the problem.
I hope he's got a good camera for his next film. Bloody hell.
And we're going to sign off now and say thank you very much for listening, and look out for this on YouTube as well. Thank you, John, and thank you, Bob.
Lynched.
Muad'Dib.